From the Sky News Centre at 5, the UK steel industry is facing further job losses, this time from Tata Steel. It's expected to cut 1,200 posts at sites in Scunthorpe, Motherwell and near Glasgow. Early this month, Thai firm SSI decided to close its steel plant in Redcar on Teesside. Business presenter Ian King says UK firms have been struggling with competition.
China has been dumping cheap steel onto the European markets for quite some time. China is an enormous steel producer in its own right. I mean, it's been estimated recently that China now has annual steel production capacity equivalent to what the UK industry puts out over 50 years.
One of the men who raided the Hatton Garden Safe Deposit Centre in London in April has led police to part of the loot. Danny Jones was taken to a North London cemetery from his high security prison. Three people have been arrested and bailed in Cardiff following claims a local couple paid up to £11,000 for a baby. A six-week-old boy is now being cared for by authorities. An organisation which represents cabbies in London says it's disappointed and surprised after the High Court ruled Uber is legal. The Licensed Taxi Drivers Association had asked judges to ban the car hailing app and will now appeal against today's decision. Chairman Richard Massett insists Uber breaks the rules.
The legislation states that private hire vehicles clearly shouldn't have meters in their cars, and what we've got here is a device that's being used as a taxi meter. It's not being used as anything else. It calculates a fare on a time and distance basis.
Cricket captain Alistair Cook was out for 263 in England's first innings of their opening test with Pakistan in Abu Dhabi. At 836 minutes, it's the longest test innings by an Englishman. They've closed day four on 569 for eight, a lead of 46. That's the latest. I'm Anna Jones.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is former leader of the Bristol City Council. He's a councillor for Clifton East, sits on George Ferguson's cabinet for the Lib Dems, Simon Cook. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, some peace rally, over 100 mostly Kurdish peace activists are killed in the Turkish capital, Ankara, last Saturday, even more seriously injured. And those that were trying to help the victims were tear gassed by police. To show they're not afraid, even more came out onto the streets the day after. The government say it was an ISIS suicide bomber or bombers, but the activists say the Turkish government planted bombs in the crowd. Fake stories about Russian jets being shot down and Russian cruise missiles crashing in Iran. Who plants these stories in the press, and why don't editors check to see if they're true before they send these lies round the world? And Dutch investigators say Malaysian airliner MH17 was shot down by a Russian-made missile, probably a Buk. But what about the black box and cockpit voice recorder? Do they really have no evidence at all? How do we know? And Al Megrahi's dead, but there are new suspects this week in the Pan Am Lockerbie bombing. Fed up with years of lies, relatives of the victims say they want proof, the evidence of the new people being involved. So, is it more jobs, more trade, or just a dictatorship run by the banks and corporations? What will TTIP mean for Bristol? That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 degrees Celsius and dry this weekend, highs of 14 Celsius, mainly cloudy weekend, but without rain. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, mainly cloudy, with an occasional shower, sunnier at the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 24th and 25th of October, around about the same temperature, highs around 14 Celsius, Next weekend, sunshine and showers, though. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Councillor for Clifton East, who also sits on George Ferguson's cabinet for the Lib Dems, Simon Cook. Hi, Simon. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Good to be here.
Tell us a bit about the changes, because you were leader of the council before the mayoral system came along.
Yeah.
What's the difference now?
Before we had a leader in cabinet, so the leader was effectively first among equals, and the cabinet took decisions jointly. Now the system is that we have a directly elected mayor who takes all the key decisions, and the cabinet effectively have an advisory role. That's the main difference. The actual powers of the mayor as opposed to the leader are virtually no different. It's just the way that those powers are decided, really.
So you're one of George Ferguson's advisers.
Mm.
I mean, this must be a bit of an awkward role, because what happens when he just simply doesn't listen?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, he ultimately has to listen to us, which he does, and he listens to the public, the feedback that he gets, and he then makes a decision according to his judgment, which is his electoral mandate. Most of the decisions, you know, are the cabinet feels comfortable with, the overwhelming majority of decisions, in fact, and we review all the key decisions at cabinet agenda conferences with the mayor before we actually go into the meeting. So I don't think that this is a kind of elective dictatorship. And, you know, I do believe George is a guy who listens anyway. There have been certain decisions he's taken where some of the cabinet have disagreed, and he's done it on the base of the principle he thinks is right. And, you know, that is his mandate, and so he should if he feels particularly strongly about a particular issue.
Don't you have to be a bit careful how far you push a point with George, though, because you might find yourself elbowed out like someone like Mark Bradshaw was?
No, I don't think Mark was dismissed because he disagreed. George always says, you know, you can disagree with me as much as you like, and I welcome that because I want to know a variety of opinions around a particular subject. What I felt, I think, and you'd have to ask George personally about this, but what George said at the time was he felt Mark was mounting a political stunt. Now, that's what he felt, because Mark at the time was angling to be the Labour candidate for mayor next year. So I think it was more the kind of the action that Mark took, which George felt was political in its nature, and not really in the spirit of the decision that was being taken. That was George's view.
Okay, so say, for example, you decided you wanted to stand for as Lib Dem mayor in the future,
which
against George. No?
Which I don't.
Well, but if you did, I mean, you'd be in a similar situation, wouldn't you?
Well, I think if I had wanted to become my party's candidate, I did that last time and they turned me down. So, you know, once bitten, twice shy. But if I had wanted to do that, then I would have said to George, look, if I get selected, I will have to stand down from your cabinet. And because it wouldn't really be tenable for a person who was going to be a rival candidate to be with him and advising him. So I don't think that would have been a problem.
Now, are there any points that you've been in discussion with George where you really felt he's not listening, or does he listen to pretty much everything you say? I mean, I'm just, there's this situation, isn't it, where you're not, you know, I suppose for us outside the cabinet, we're thinking, well, to what extent do people like Simon have the ability to actually twist George's arm a bit when they feel really strongly about something?
Yeah, we put our views very strongly, and we did over libraries, for instance. I mean, you know, we had some tough cabinet meetings with the officers about the library changes, and I think we got some changes that we felt were right. In other words, we weren't going to close seven libraries. we were going to reduce ours across the piece and keep all the libraries open, apart from Eastville, which I think is the right decision because it's not doesn't really sit in a community. But, you know, yes, I mean, I remember when early on in his term, he discussed with me that he was going to do the residence parking schemes. I advised him very strongly that that would meet with a lot of opposition and he should be careful. I didn't necessarily say to him, I think it's the wrong thing, but when we were running the council, we only introduced those schemes by consent. But he chose to introduce them, no matter what people felt about it, he felt it was the right thing to do, and that's his right to do that. But I advised him that I felt, you know, there would be a lot of unhappiness with it. But he still went ahead, which is, you know, that's his right.
He's right to do that. What would you, if you've been seeing any issues, how would you have done it differently, apart from just this basic thing of doing it by consent, that is only when a community wants a parking scheme?
Yeah, I mean, I think we always took that view that we wanted to be absolutely convinced that the community in question really wanted these schemes because they are big changes and you're asking people to pay for parking, whereas previously it was free. So we, you know, that's always the policy we followed when we implemented the Kingsdown one and then the Cottam South one. But George felt that in order to make the necessary change and the kind of the shift to keep commuter parking out of the city and therefore, in his view, to improve air quality and to reduce congestion, and I think he's right about that, it just had to be done, and he'd been elected by the whole city. He felt he had the mandate to do that.
Now, tell us a bit about yourself, Simon. I know you've been an actor in the past. Where might we have seen you on the telly or on the silver screen?
I was a jobbing actor for 20 years, so I turned up in Casualty and EastEnders and The Bill and all the usual things, and in lots of individual television dramas. I was in a soap called Family Affairs for a year on Channel 5, which is now gone, but it was great fun for 20 years, but you know, it's a very difficult profession, and getting work is always hard.
What took you into that, and are you still doing some acting?
Yeah, I do. I've still got an agent in London, and I still do voiceovers and occasional telly part. What took me into it? I loved it at school and at university, and then as an amateur actor, I just couldn't stop doing it, really. And then I got a place at Bristol Old Vic Theatre School, where I went. And, you know, it's great. I am a creative person at the end of it. You might then ask why I've ended up as a politician. But the skills help, I have to say.
Are there any roles you've had that you've found your real favourite roles that you really loved doing?
There've been loads, really. I was in the Royal Shakespeare Company for two seasons, and I was in a couple of shows there which I think were absolutely superb. And actually, to be in that company delivering those wonderful shows is just priceless, really.
So what were you? What part were you playing? Which Shakespearean?
In both of them, I was playing. It was Spring Awakening and by Wedekind, and a play called Son of Man by Dennis Potter. And they were ensemble companies, so we were all playing multiple parts. But Son of Man, particularly, was a play about Christ from a very kind of atheistical point of view. But and Joseph Fiennes played Christ, and we had some wonderful actors in it, and it was absolutely stunning. And people were in tears after the show. It was quite extraordinary. You know, a friend of mine came to see it, and he was crying afterwards when he came to the stage door, and then we went to the pub, and he was still crying in the pub. And, you know, that's kind of that. You can move people to that degree. There's something wonderful about that.
Well, he's a legend, isn't he, from The Forest of Dean, Dennis Potter. Shame there don't seem to be people around today, the gravitas of people like him.
He was an extraordinary talent, and an extraordinary talent at a particular time as well, you know, where his kind of, his politics as well infused his writing, and yeah, he produced some extraordinary stuff. And he was really one of the first great playwrights for television as the new modern medium, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. And he wrote for television like nobody else did, really. And it's funny. Oddly enough, Son of Man was written as a television play with Colin Blakely playing the lead part. And then Bill Bryden readjusted it back for a stage play, and it worked wonderfully on stage.
I suppose we better get back to the politics, haven't we? I'm afraid. Which is, and today, an announcement that the Chief Constable's finally resigned. What are your thoughts about this? It's taken nearly 18 months, hasn't it, since he was initially suspended. And I mean, I think you've got to take the sort of, I suppose, kind of almost a union rep's point of view here. He's been found to have committed offences which are not sackable offences, and yet he's been forced out.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunate. I had a lot of time for Nick Gargan. I thought he was a really nice guy. I think he was incredibly bright. And this, I think, has been a really torturous process. I'm sure that the Police and Crime Commissioner has followed the rule book, and she's been backed up on that. But, you know, there are MPs, for instance, who've called it a witch hunt. My only worry about this is that he was very much a reformer, and he was really forced to resign on a technicality, as you've said. And my worry is that when reformers get forced out, is there some kind of agenda behind that? But, you know, I'm not close enough to the police force to know that, and there was a lot of pressure from within the force and from people retired from the force who just felt somebody who had been found guilty, however technical it was, couldn't lead a police force.
We were talking a bit earlier on about the Metro Mayor, about the Mayor, but what about the Metro Mayor? I know Manchester has got one. I was rather perplexed to see that he hasn't actually been elected yet. He's been appointed, and I think it's maybe next May that his election is due, or at least certainly he served for a time as Mayor, as an appointee, rather than being elected. What's the prospects, do you think, what is a Metro Mayor, and then what do you think the prospects are for us getting one?
A Metro Mayor is a politician who's elected for a city region. In other words, Manchester's had a combined authority. In other words, a relationship between Manchester City Council and all the surrounding authorities for some time now. And it is a politician elected to be the mayor of that whole area, not just a city as we have, and to be to have power over the big strategic issues like transport, spatial strategy, housing, and now health, of course, in the Manchester deal. So it will be a very powerful post. Will it come to the west of England? I don't know. We have suggested a combined authority. That was in our bid. But, you know, our bid has not yet been decided on by government, so we wait to see.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, better bring you on in this mayor business, because it does seem like it's a bit of a concentration of power from the old days. I mean, where it used to be elected councillors had a much bigger role, the cabinet had a bigger role, not just as advisers, but with a little bit more clout than they do nowadays. What are your thoughts about this and the possibility Simon's saying there that we may, you know, become a city region with a mayor actually running a wider area?
Well, I think it's most unlikely that we will be a city region, because there's such a political variation across what used to, you know, the counties that used to be Avon or Cuba or whatever. I mean, there used to be a city region, as it were, and that was dismantled. And the politics of it are rather more sharp in where we are. I mean, in the north of England, it's pretty much a Labour heartland, so that, you know, they can talk about having a wider city region in which the political parties are likely to agree.
That's a good point, Simon. Is it a throwback, do you think, to the old Avon business?
Well, I mean, I think Avon is a kind of ghastly memory which nobody wants to go back to in this part of the world. But having said that, in the West of England Partnership, the four authorities work, you know, very well together. And I sit on a couple of West of England partnership boards, Joint Transport Board and the Housing Board, and you know, I think generally they work very well. So I think it is perfectly possible for the four authorities here to work together. The suggestion is a combined authority, but the Metro Mayor, I think, was actually decided by government for Manchester. So Manchester hadn't asked for that, but government, looking at the bid that Manchester had put in for devolution of finance particularly, said, well, if you get this devolved power and funding, you will have to have a Metro Mayor, and Manchester chose to accept it. Now, you know, that's not been suggested to us. And because our bid has not really finished being considered. So I've no idea whether the government will suggest the same for the west of England. But I do agree with Martin. I think it would be difficult. It would be more difficult here because this is a more diverse political area.
Okay. Also, I know part of your responsibility is for parks, isn't it? And I was chatting to
not parks, no.
Events that take place in parks. So, do you have to do any negotiation with parks people, saying, "Well, is it okay to take over this park for this event?"
Well, there's certain parks in the city are designated as venues, so that the events team know that they can be used. Queen Square is one of those, Castle Park, Ashton Court, of course, is another one.
Because there are some people that say, well, hang on, why are you using our parks for these events, especially if they're commercial companies coming in, and people can't actually afford to go to the event? That's taking over people's valuable open space.
Well, they're not here for very long, generally, and, you know, mostly the parks, we have 400 green spaces in the city. Mostly the parks are available. The city centre ones are used because, you know, people like events in a city. And, some of the events are free, like the Harbour Festival. Some of them are not, like Arcadia. And we always try and keep, you know, if it is to be charged for, we try and keep prices as low as possible. But I think people like, you know, to have lively events in the city centre. We're very well known for it. We're very good at it. And why not?
Well, he says he's going to stand for mayor next year. His name's Paul Saville. He's a local activist, was a student at the University of the West of England. And he had this to say to me earlier this week about the way that some of the parks are being used for these events.
Basically, it's public space, the way I see it, limited public space, especially in the city centre, like Queen's Square. You've got Castle Park, what else? We've got Brandon Hill, you've got King's Square, which is not particularly brilliant or big, but it's another public space which is green, you know. What I've seen, I mean, not just this summer, but in previous summers, is spaces being turned into private property, private property. Often with big Harris fencing set up, private events happening, which is fine, you know, they're paying their way and stuff. But then basically there's this time where they're setting up, so say the event's for 3 nights or something. Either side of that, there's 4 days of setting up and packing down. So you've basically seen, say for example, Queen's Square shut for 4 days before, 2 days for the festival, say, and then 4 days, that's what is 10 days. 10 days for pack down event and pack up again, which means that all of that time, that public space has been lost. And this summer I counted seven events, which were open to public, but you had to pay to be there, and it was largely focused around alcohol. There was a Magna's cider comedy event, there was a Thai festival, there's a Harbourside festival, which is a story in itself, with all of the outside businesses coming into Bristol and leaving a right mess in Bristol Green Capital. But like I said, another story. And essentially, you know, it's our spaces, not the council spaces. That's my main kind of gripe with it, is that it's our space to decide what goes on with it, not just head honchos in Bristol City Council.
Well, I suppose by head honchos, Paul's talking about you there, Simon. What are your thoughts about what he's got to say there about taking over public space?
Well, yeah, we use public space, but do you want really good events in the city, or don't you? And most people do. And you know, okay, he's talking about Arcadia in Queen Square, that's pretty clear, which was quite a long build-up and about a 3-day takedown. Arcadia is, you know, that's a one-off. That isn't going to happen for a very long time. Arcadia was created in Bristol, it's been to Glastonbury in the West Country, but but nowhere else near. It goes around the world. It has an international following. It is an amazing event. Why shouldn't it come to Bristol? And does it really matter at the end of the day when there's still plenty of space in the city centre to go and sit out and have a drink? Does it really matter that it was, you know, Queen Square was very busy for a week with them setting it up and the show happening and them taking it down? It was a tremendous opportunity to get Arcadia. There were, you know, 30,000 very happy people went along and paid to go along from all sorts of backgrounds. I think it was fabulous, and Bristol should be doing that.
What was Arcadia? I mean, I didn't go to it. What was it about?
Arcadia is an amazing spider created out of recycled sort of metal bits, I mean, from jet engines to bits of cranes. It's a fantastic thing, and it's, there's a kind of dramatic and rock performance happens within this, with lots of incredible lighting. And
the spider stays on the stage, does it?
It does. It is. It's been to Glastonbury. If you just Google it, you can see. You'll see find lots of pictures of it. It is an amazing spectacle, and hey, lots of people enjoyed it. So why not?
And what about the alcohol involved in sponsorship? Is that inevitable or what?
I think alcohol sponsorship is, you know, for those events. I think it was the TP events, the restaurant, the pop-up restaurant. I know it's for the comedy event there. But again, you know, that was packed out, sold out. People love it. It's actually come from London, but then they heard, you know, the reputation Bristol has for being a vibrant city, so they wanted to come and do it. We encouraged them to do it. I encouraged them when I was leader to come and do it. And it's been happening in Queen Square every year. Again, fabulous event. A lot of people love it. You know, we like people to have a good time in this city, to have great joy in Bristol. Okay, you could have all the green spaces and all the spaces in the city empty, nothing ever happening. I don't think people would choose that.
What about the argument that some people just simply can't afford to go to these? I mean, they can hardly afford to pay the bills sometimes, and to go to these events is they're actually being excluded from.
Well, I mean, I think we always try and keep them as low as possible. Harbour Festival's free, but you know, Colson Hall is publicly owned. They have to charge for concerts, obviously. We always try and keep prices as low as we can, but you know, if you say we're never going to put on anything unless everybody can come, frankly we wouldn't be doing much at all. It's back to this thing: do you want Bristol to be this lively, fantastic city where endless things happen? And you know, the amount that's on in this city on any one particular night is staggering. I think it's great, and it's great for our economic impact, and actually it employs a lot of people. So yeah, let's enjoy that and not drag it down.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts on this, using public space for these sorts of events? Because, I mean, you could imagine, actually, possibly, even private land could be used. This is being done on a public park.
Well, I presume that these private organisations have to pay the City Council to use the space.
Yeah.
So there is a commercial aspect to this.
Yeah, yeah.
And it leads to resources being made available to the City Council, which can then be committed to other things like libraries or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the case?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we do charge. I mean, it's not vast amounts of money, Martin, but and they also have to pay a bond so that, for instance, Queen Square, the grass was compromised, and it's now being re-turfed and reseeded, and they pay for that.
Yeah,
Just like they do on the Downs. You know, there's a circus on the Downs at the moment. They will pay a bond.
So, in other words, the idea is that the City Council, at the very least, should not be out of pocket.
Yeah,
by putting these events on.
Absolutely. No, we're not throwing public money at it in that sense, but we do make these spaces available, and I think people are, you know, on the whole, pretty glad that we do.
Okay, on to another story this week, and that is to do with the end of the Wilson Doctrine. Martin, maybe you can tell us something about that, because this is apparently Harold Wilson, many years ago, came to some sort of agreement with the security services that MPs and elected officials like Simon here wouldn't be put under surveillance. Is that that this week has been ruled incorrect by the Information Tribunal? Well, what is the Wilson Doctrine?
Well, you just outlined what it was, that in theory elected politicians should not have their communications with constituents to be bugged or or spied upon by the security services. Although I must admit that I have my doubts if it's ever been enforced. This is perhaps what's happening now, is that people are just facing up to the reality of what the situation has always been.
It might be that quite a lot of this legislation is just to bring into a legal... correct legal position stuff that's been going on illegally.
Well, that's right.
But anyway, let's have a listen now to a question which was put a few weeks ago at Prime Minister's Questions by the Conservative MP David Davis.
David Davis! In 2011, the Prime Minister quite rightly confirmed to the House that the Wilson Doctrine, the prohibition on the electronic monitoring of members of Parliament, was still in force. Unfortunately, in July 24th of this year, the government's lawyer, Mr. James Eadie QC, stated in the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, in answer to a complaint from the Honourable Lady, the member for Brighton Pavilion, that the Wilson Doctrine is not legally binding, cannot work properly, and accordingly places no obligations on agencies. This is clearly inconsistent with the Prime Minister's previous statement. Can he clarify the status of the doctrine to the House today and confirm it has real meaning?
I've got nothing to add to comments I've made about this issue before, but I'm very happy to write to the Honourable Gentleman and set out the position.
Well, Simon Cook, what do you make of this?
I actually hadn't heard about this. I mean, it seems to be restricted purely to MPs. I mean, I can't think anybody would really want to monitor the email exchanges I have with my constituents about parking and waste issues. Maybe they do. Maybe GCHQ is looking at my inbox even now.
I mean, the problem here is that people like you are actually asking some awkward questions sometimes, aren't you, of people in power, and particularly MPs. This is something that surely a bit... I mean, it's also a similar situation with journalists. We want to know that the security services, particularly for foreign powers like the United States, can't just read our emails and go through all our contacts of our computer willy-nilly, that there at least is some sort of legal guarantees there.
No, I think that's right, and certainly members of Parliament should have that protection, I think. Members of Parliament have interchanges with their constituents about very sensitive issues, personal issues, and it's disturbing, I think, to think that that can be viewed by not only our National Security Service, but by maybe international security services under the guise that they're allies. Obviously, higher up the chain, yeah, there are big security issues at stake, I would have thought.
Martin, this echoes here of Watergate a bit, aren't there? Because that was what the Watergate scandal was about, the Republican Party in the US using the CIA and the intelligence services in America to spy on their political opposition.
Well, it reminds me of what happened some years ago. Now, I can't remember when it was. It was one of the elections. Somebody broke into Labour Party headquarters and stole the hard drives of their election planning, basically. And the suggestion at the time that it was the security service that had done this, presumably in order to tip off the Tories about what they needed to know about what the Labour Party
was. Well, isn't it more likely to have been the opposition party, the Tory party, doing it themselves?
Well, this is the issue, isn't it? If elections are quite the strategy of the spin doctors and so on is kept under wraps, and if intelligence services are able, or somebody is able, to break in, get access to that, and then tip off the political opponents of whoever has been targeted, then there is clearly an issue. I think it's quite interesting that David Davis has raised this, because he's building a profile for himself as a sort of civil libertarian on the Tory benches. I mean, speaking from my point of view as an activist, I just presume that if anything serious is going on, it is being monitored, and you've got to take that into account in terms of what you and how you organise. Basically, if you want to keep things secret, then don't use telephones, and don't use the internet.
Well, according to Edward Snowden, Simon's nodding there. So, according to Edward Snowden, smartphones are very much accessed by security services, by GCHQ. What they're called is signals intelligence, isn't it? Mm. The NSA in America, National Security Agency, and GCHQ up in Cheltenham here. And on a Panorama documentary last week, this is what the reporter and Edward Snowden had a bit of a discussion about how secure our smartphones are. Answer is, not very.
Mm. Bulk data can also be collected in a more intimate and personal way via hacking our smartphones. They now account for an increasing amount of all internet traffic, and are a godsend for the agencies, the secret doorway to all our data and internet use. What information, what intelligence can the agencies get from this, a smartphone? Snowden told us about a secret GCHQ training program codenamed Smurfs, cartoon characters devised by Belgian comic artist Peyo.
Dreamy Smurf is the power management tool, which means turning your phone on or off without you knowing.
Even if I've turned my phone off?
Right.
And then we've got Nosy Smurf. What's Nosy Smurf?
Nosy Smurf is the hot miking tool. So, for example, if it's in your pocket, they can turn the microphone on and listen to everything that's going on around you.
Even if my phone is switched off?
Even if your phone's switched off, because they've got the other...
Tracker Smurf. What's Tracker Smurf?
That's a geolocation tool which allows them to follow you with a greater precision than you would get from the typical triangulation of cell phone towers.
That was Edward Snowden there talking on Panorama last week. Simon Cook, what are your thoughts? Because to a certain extent, you could imagine people getting a bit paranoid about this, thinking that everything is being listened to. But there's also a civil liberties issue too. So where's the balance between the two?
I think the balance is very difficult. I mean, you think of Harold Wilson, who was Prime Minister in the 60s and 70s. You know, technology was just nothing like what it is now, and the technology is incredibly invasive. I mean, a lot of councillors will say to colleagues, don't email it to me. Don't put it on email. It's not safe. And
so that's good old-fashioned paper is a better way, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, or meeting somebody in a coffee house and making sure nobody's around you. I mean, that does sound paranoid, but, I mean, actually, email isn't safe. And, I had my email, my council inbox hacked into by someone who was actually employed by the city council. He was then dismissed. But, you never really know who's watching. And, I mean, look, the traffic just in the city council is absolutely enormous. You know, I mean, millions and millions of emails a year. But even so, technology is such that, you know, vast amounts of data can be analysed very, very quickly. For the most part, you know, the sort of stuff that we deal with at local level is not going to attract a lot of interest. But at national level and international level, yeah, there are serious security implications. And yeah, don't let's be fooled. Look, your mobile phone is a pathway from somebody else into your private life. If you're happy with that, as I generally am, I think, because I don't think I'm a terribly interesting person, that's fine. But if it is abused because of the position I hold at the moment, that is not right.
And that sounds quite nasty about having your email account hacked. How did you know? Because, I mean, if someone's really stealthy, they can be reading your emails and then you would probably never be any the wiser.
Officers were informing me of events via email, informing me of information by email, and I said, well, you never sent me the email. And he wrote back, and yeah, I sent it to you on this day at this time, and I went into my inbox and it wasn't there, it had been opened and deleted by somebody else.
Oh, right, okay. So
they then set a trap and called in some experts from outside, and the guy was tracked.
Amazing. Martin, we're moving down this technological road without often the legalities and the laws to govern it.
Well, I think it's fairly clear the so-called Snoopers Charter, that what was actually going on there, GCHQ were asking for ex post facto justification or legal cover for what they were already doing.
Yes.
And you can imagine that, you know, political parties like Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland have basically presumed that they're being bugged continuously. And many of them will have been trained in techniques for counter-surveillance and so on. I think the fact is that there's no point in presuming that anybody can access. It's not just the security services. It could be foreign security services. It could be criminal groups. Anybody can access electronic information. So if you want to keep things secret, so for example, if you've got something that's politically sensitive, for example, that you don't want to come out, then you mustn't send emails about it. I mean, there's all this fuss now in America about Hillary Clinton's emails around the Benghazi incident. And of course, she's facing questions about, you know, deleting these emails and using a private email for public purposes. And of course, what's probably bubbling under there is that what they were doing was taking ex-Libyan military equipment and shipping it to Syria to arm various factions in Syria. And that's what she was up to, and that's what they were up to. And so, in other words, this can cut both ways. That the fact is that those, you know, the people in the LIBOR scandal or whatever, they are all actually punishable because the evidence is there. So it's not just the citizen that's got to watch out. Those in the government that are misbehaving had better watch out as well, because all of their emails are ultimately there to be accessed by prosecutors and so on.
I suppose the message to come out of this is back to the old-fashioned ways, bits of paper and coffee shops.
Well, in the Russians have now gone back to using typewriters in their internal security
systems. Simon, what do you view the final word on this?
I don't use a typewriter. I continue to use email, but I am very careful about what I put on email sometimes if it's a very sensitive subject. And I might use private email accounts occasionally, because I think it's sensible to do that. But, you know, ultimately, these are not matters within local government of national security, but they're sometimes very sensitive issues. And, you know, politicians and senior officers need to know that you can carry on a dialogue when you're analysing and thinking about a particular issue and testing it. They need to be able to believe that this can be confidential and not everything leaked outside, because some, you know, politicians and senior people in organisations like local government need to be able to think out of the box, but not necessarily have that thinking in the public domain until it's been tested and we know it's right. So you need to be able to discuss things, and you need to be able to be secure. And I think it is increasingly worrying that the evidence is that actually nothing is secure.
Yeah, particularly when you think about lawyers, journalists, politicians having their emails looked at.
Absolutely.
This is potentially a very dark and dangerous road to go down. Anyway, back to Westminster, and this week we had Prime Minister's questions for the first time for a few weeks because of the party conference season, where Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron locked horns in the politest possible fashion.
I thank the Prime Minister for that. Can I tell him, in case he's not aware of it, that she's going to be £1,800 a year worse off next April?
It's about tax credits.
There are another 3 million families in this country who will also be worse off next April, and that after housing costs, 500,000 more children are now in poverty compared with 5 years ago in 2010. And on top of that, his new tax credit policy will put another 200,000 children into poverty. Isn't the truth of the matter that this government is taking away the opportunities and limiting the life chances of hundreds of thousands of children from poorer or middle-income families in this society? And should he not be aware of that in the decisions he makes?
Yeah. Well, the fact is that since I became Prime Minister, there are 480,000 fewer children in households where nobody works. There are 2 million more people in work. There are almost 1 million more women in work. There are 250,000 more young people in work. The best route out of poverty is to help people get a job. And that's why, even though the unemployment figures came out today and we see 140,000 more people in work, he still hasn't welcomed the fall in unemployment that took place today. But the point he needs to focus on is this, is that all these people benefit from a growing economy where wages are rising, where inflation is falling, and where we're getting rid of our deficit to create economic stability. And it's that stability that we'll be voting on in the lobbies tonight.
Well, that's kind of throwback to Prime Minister's questions of yore, isn't it, really? I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's asking about tax credits, and he's responding with the usual kind of boilerplate about the economy. The fact is, as Corbyn pointed out, lots of people will be worse off through the withdrawal of tax credits. And many people are, in fact, just as badly off in work as they previously used to be on benefits. That's not necessarily a progress from the point of view of the individuals concerned.
And what he's referring to, the fiscal charter there, this is this law which has been passed this week, which says that they won't have any... the government has to balance the books. So some people referring it to as to the Permanent Austerity Act.
Well, speaking as an economist, I think the idea that the government should tie its own hands to say what it will and won't do with public expenditure in a situation where the global economy is incredibly fragile is just bonkers. It's like telling somebody how to drive a car in advance and saying, you know, whatever obstacles in the road there are, whatever accidents you come across, you have got to stick to driving in third gear. It doesn't make any sense. And most governments, in actual fact, in practice, it won't work like that. What will happen? I mean, Osborne already, for example, did not reduce the deficit in one parliament because he couldn't. And if he'd tried to do it, he wouldn't have been re-elected. So he didn't. And I think this stuff is basically economically illiterate. And it was foolish of John McDonnell to even suggest that he would sign up for it. And I understand, so speaking to you earlier, Simon, the Liberal Democrats voted against exactly this.
They did, yeah. And Osborne himself, of course, condemned the idea of that when they were in opposition.
Hmm.
Before the 2010 election, and suddenly now he's doing it because I think he thinks it looks macho. But I mean, you know, it is an absurd idea, and I think actually one of the really unfortunate things at the moment is that, you know, what they're doing around tax credits, what they're doing around promoting the right to buy for housing association tenants, they're doing about reducing public rents by 1%, is damaging. You know, the housing, the potential for us to be able to generate more social and affordable housing, the reduction in support will be making people more impoverished. But you know, all of that is just not noticed in the media at the moment because the media are obsessed with Jeremy Corbyn and his effect on the Labour Party and the fact that the Labour Party, is in a bit of a mess. But that's not right. We should be right at the top of the headlines should be what the government is doing in terms of its social policies. And these are very damaging and they're very socially divisive. And I'm just sorry that that's not taking the headlines, but what is a load of guff and nonsense around personalities who are running particular parties. That will come out in the wash and during the elections, what the electorate think about that. But everybody's obsessed with it, and I think that's really unfortunate.
One of the people who's been commenting on the wisdom or otherwise of austerity is the Greek finance minister. Sorry, not the Greek, he's ex-Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis. And just a few weeks ago on BBC's Question Time, he had this to say about whether the national finances can be easily compared to your personal finances on your credit card.
Politicians spend so much time arguing amongst themselves about the problem. Economics is really simple. I've got £10 in my pocket. If I go out and buy 3 pints of beer, I'm probably borrowing money. If I carry on doing that, then I'm going to run out of money and I'm going to go bust. It's not difficult, guys. Just sit down, work out what the country needs to do and work collectively together.
Because the country does not operate as your budget does.
We have a budget.
But why not? Why not? Why not?
In the country, total expenditure equals total income. In your life, you have a wonderful independence between your expenses and your income. So when you cut down on your expenses, your income is not cut. But for the country as a whole, if the country as a whole goes into major savings spree, then its total income is going to come down. So your personal life is not a good model on which to base...
Martin, can you just explain that a little bit for us? I mean, he's saying there that there is something to do with the spending. People's ordinary people's spending actually then brings in tax receipts, but that doesn't operate on a personal level.
Well, I mean, it's a fairly simple point, although you'd be surprised how many A-level students don't get it, which is that if you're talking about more than one person or a group of people or a national economy, one person's expenditure is somebody else's income. So if everybody tries to save and tries to reduce their expenditure, what will happen is that the general level of economic activity will go down. Now, this, of course, has been well understood by economists for at least 50 or 60 years. So although it's very successful from a political and ideological point of view to compare the country to an individual or to an individual family and its credit card, it's simply wrong. It's one of the first things I was taught as an economist in the 1970s is national economies don't function like that. It's counterintuitive, but it's actually true. And of course, it's been very politically successful. It's certainly persuaded a lot of people who don't really understand what goes on that this is what they've got to do. And it's very pervasive, but it's simply wrong.
Simon, what do you make about this? Because it seems that we are, almost all of us are being called on to try to get to grips with national economics, to actually understand what's going on, the rights and wrongs, and who to vote for, who to support, who not to.
Well, I think, you know, as ever, for me, there has to be a balance. I don't believe you can go on borrowing recklessly, endlessly. I think what the coalition did in attempting to rein back the deficit was right. Ironically, of course, borrowing went up. And I guess that's the cycle before it starts coming down.
Can you just explain that, Martin? Why would that happen? Why, if you're trying to do the right thing, why would you have to borrow
more? What happens when you get a big crash like happened in 2008?
Hang on, it wasn't a crash, it was a bailout.
No, it was a bailout, but what happens in a modern economy, what would have happened in the 19th century?
It was a world crash.
In the 19th century, where the government was much smaller and where there were no social benefits, what would happen is that the crash would happen and it would carry on, and it carry on indefinitely. Once the economy starts shrinking, it could go right down the drain. But the existence of a welfare state and a bit of redistribution actually provides a cushion for the economy in hard times. So that the deficit going up is a natural function of what they call the automatic stabilisers of a welfare state economy. And that means that in actual fact, instead of the economy crashing, it's like an airbag which actually prevents that from happening. Now, I do agree that you can't just you can't run endless deficits. There's obviously a limit to how far the government can intervene, either deliberately or just through the natural fiscal stabilisers. But the idea that you can run a modern capitalist economy without a welfare state and redistribution is simply wrong. The welfare state and redistribution and things like unemployment benefits and housing benefits are not optional add-ons. Without them, the economy would crash through the floor and keep going. And I think that's not well understood. I mean, we need to actually educate a lot of people more about how national economies and international economies work. And it's not just a question of taking a middle view. I think in actual practice, governments all over the world have ended up spending a lot more than they intended to, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't mean that we've solved the problem, but if we try to cut back expenditure too dramatically, too quickly, as we saw in the early phases of the coalition government last time, the economy stalled. And then, of course, what happened is Osborne, presumably under pressure from people like Vince Cable, sort of realised that they couldn't go down that road and started to behave more rationally. But we need to actually have a more rational discussion about this instead of everybody beating each other over the head about it.
Chris, I mean, I make the point about the terminology, the crash, because we had one in 1929, which was had a massive effect right across the Western world, people being laid off, enormous mass unemployment, mass poverty, people not being able to pay.
There was no protection.
Yeah,
for the low paid.
I mean, now, Martin, I mean, if a similar sort of thing happened with the banks collapsing and the stock market crashing.
That is a worry, because that shot has been used. That locker is now empty. But, of course, you're right. In 1929, those things didn't exist.
Well, no, surely the government would just do the same now as they did then.
Yeah, but what Roosevelt did in the United States is he brought in all of those measures, which set up a welfare state. That helped to push the economy out of the negative situation that it had got itself into. I mean, the main insight of Keynes, who was a liberal economist, was that if the economy can function at any level, so it can function at a low level or a high level, and you can actually get stuck in a low level functioning state. And if the government doesn't break that down by taking decisive action, then you can stick in that state for virtually indefinitely. It used to be well understood, this sort of thing. It was well understood across the political spectrum. Tories like Macmillan and Edward Heath were Keynesians. But of course, what's happened since then is a kind of intellectual counter-revolution, where the belief that we could go back to how things were in the 19th century and it would all be wonderful. I would suggest that people should look at the results of that and make the appropriate judgment. It wasn't really a sensible policy, and it never was.
And it was in but it's amazing how powerful the kind of idea that
you do compare a country and the world to a household. You know, yep. Margaret Thatcher was very good at that.
Yep.
She used to say, you know, she was the grocer's daughter. You know, my father never spent more than he earned. And these, you know, that is very resonant to a lot of people who don't understand, probably people like me, who don't understand the unbelievable complexity of international economics.
Well, we've got something even more complex this week, which is inflation going below zero again. Martin, what's going on?
Well, inflation is actually, there's a lot of dispute about how inflation is measured. I mean, in this country, for example, things like
this
housing...
The Office of National Statistics saying this.
They keep changing the measure. I mean, in Britain, for example, housing costs are not included in the core inflation measure, which is absurd.
Quote,
I mean, I spend two-thirds of my income on my housing costs.
Let me just quote here. Even stripping out more volatile prices such as fuel and food, a so-called core measure of inflation, undershot expectations in September. The ONS said the rate... held at 1%, defying a forecast for 1.1%. But so the overall rate is actually down. I mean, what's going on in the macroeconomics to make that happen?
I'm just putting a caveat on the inflation measure, because in actual fact, if you included things like housing costs and asset values, the stock market is still up. It's coming down now, but it's been massively increased. House prices have increased, but that's not included in the measure. But what's the real fear here is that we're going to get back into deflation, which we haven't had since the 1930s. Mm. Prices falling, and you think, oh, that'd be good. But what that means is that people put off purchases because they know that the thing is going to be cheaper further down the line, and that starts to really seize up all of the consumer demand in the economy.
Okay, well, thanks for helping clear up some of those macroeconomic issues, which always seems to be like gobbledygook to me. Bristol City Council considers revised park bylaws. Now, Simon, I know you're not directly responsible for parks, but this includes, apparently, at the next full council meeting, a decision being made on these bylaws. Council consent will be needed for 12 activities in parks, including building structures, lighting fires and camping. Now, I'm quite sure that there are a lot of homeless people. We hear that there's homeless people sleeping in 9 of our parks at the moment. This is going to be pretty bad for them, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't like to think of anyone sleeping in a park, particularly now when the weather's getting unbelievably cold. But this is about reforming, or getting rid of some old Victorian bylaws, which really aren't appropriate anymore, and trying to see what are those aspects of behaviour that are sufficiently antisocial and damaging to parks and to the peace of the local neighbourhood that should be controlled. But, you know, I do want to emphasise that we will be very careful about the implementation of these. We don't want to be dogmatic about it. We don't want to spoil people's fun. But, you know,
it's not fun, isn't it? If you're having to, you know, you haven't got anywhere to live and you're going to go to a park.
That's a separate point, Tony. Honestly, I think, you know, we should be ensuring that anybody who's considering sleeping in a park is taking to proper shelter and given a proper place to sleep. But this is about, it's not really about
but
that.
There aren't enough places, are there?
Well, we need to ensure that there are, but you know, this is about basically kind of silly antisocial behaviour that damages parks, keeps people awake at night, and we want that stopped, and that's right, and it's about tidying up old Victorian laws.
I mean, what's going to happen is homeless people are just going to start sleeping on bits of waste ground that are out of the public eye. It's a way of kind of pushing it away from where public can see them.
No, I think we need, you know, to be much more active around people sleeping, rough sleeping, and getting them proper places to sleep. But, you know, sometimes people choose to do it by choice, even though there is a shelter available. So, you know, no, I hate to think of somebody in a park when the nights are as cold as they are now. So I'm, you know, but this is not really about that. This is about trying to make sure that parks are kept really good places for, and safe places for children and families to use.
Well, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest there, councillor for Clifton East, also sits on George Ferguson's cabinet for the Lib Dems, Simon Cook. After the Murdoch News, some peace rally after over 100 mostly Kurdish peace activists killed in the Turkish capital Ankara last Saturday.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol.